No offense to Great Rooms for. I just sat in a guy's basement in Venice. Not basement, his back house in Venice. The composer, the whole thing. He was just literally in one room the size of this thing. Had
his
board.
That's where we used to be.
He was unbelievable. Wrote the score, sent it to Macedonia. Mm-hmm. I think it was like $8,000, 24 pieces, overdubbed. Incredible. Like an hour and 10 minutes of music for $9,000. Beautiful strings.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you have, we're so loose. We don't do like, even,
we don't even tell people who the guests are.
Because we figure they'll know when they come in. Do you have anything you want me to hit? Because I'm going to kind of just run through a few of your things.
To hit?
You what?
You mean it to promote? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. No, to make to identify you.
Yeah, is there something you
as an auteur?
Okay, what would be on my imagistic tombstone, if you will?
I'd say
it would probably be. Why do I think about it? I was just actually at Forest Lawn, ironically. The director of Pearl Jam's Jeremy. And Arlington Road, and a few
girls in their summer clothes. If we're going down,
there you go. And Blind Spot and Cold Case.
For those of you who aren't versed
from TV shows,
these are music videos. Some of these are TV shows. Some of these are feature.
This is the whole point. I didn't realize we were because we do this.
You always say you don't know where.
No, but I actually didn't know where we were on. We were.
He gets to edit it, so he gets to cut himself out if he does
stupid. Arlington Road was my first sort of real Hollywood agent, the guy who found me when I was stuck in the straight-to-video world. His name's Matt Bedrosian, but he represented Aaron Kruger,
Absolutely.
Who sold that script. And I was like...
Aaron Kruger used to drive around in a little purple gremlin. He was an assistant to somebody over at Fox.
And everything goes back to Joe.
And Peter and Peter Samuelson was on the Nichols Fellowship judging committee. And in those days, you could be a judge and scoop up all the scripts, which you can't do anymore. Mm-hmm. I understand.
Nobody wants to be a judge.
Yeah, I guess not. But that was sort of my for where you first sort of like seriously crossed my radar. And that's such a great film. But yeah, as you said, I was asking Mark, like, if there's anything specific you want me to hit, and he's running through them. But you are, I would say that thing that really is kind of like most infuriating to the rest of us in this business. You're that actual thing. You're an actual working director. You're like.
Well, I think if I probably work in more mediums than most people on a regular basis.
Videos, TV, you're just talking about the Quibi you did.
Commercials. And I think I've always done that. And I think probably I know Spike Jonze plays around a lot with different forms and stuff like that. But I've always done it. I had done a lot of videos and commercials and documentary things before I did a movie. And was always like, all it takes, I tell people, it's like, you can be really successful and live in New York, and all it takes is move to Hollywood for people to tell you that you're shit. You know what I mean? And like to really get like fucking like hit in the head and test yourself, and then work your way through economic collapse and some life calamities that take you sideways. And when you haven't made a movie in 8 years, people are like, "Where did he go?" And as this great after Arlington Road, Mothman Prophecy, 1999 and 2002. My wife passed away in 2004. So suddenly, you don't make a movie for 4 years and it's 2007. And that's a long time. At that point,
you
5
must
or
be in
6
rehab, huh?
I was in prep on a Harrison Ford movie that came out called Firewall at the time. But it was it was a very interesting noirish kind of thing called The Wrong Element at the time. Then they changed the title and all of Harrison's dopey ideas where he wants to like go fix shit with the fax machine. I'm like, no. We're gonna shit.
Now he's not coming on the show.
Anyway, you had to earn his respect. Point being, I think that you're on like different levels, and at that point, if you think, oh, I want to be a Hollywood guy, right?
Yeah.
And then something doesn't go, and a remake of The Orphanage for Guillermo del Toro doesn't happen, and the economic collapse happens. Next thing you know, you've made a couple little indies that don't work critically or commercially, and you're like, shit, it's 10 years. And people, whole new breed of people, the world of blockbusters emerges. And I was never grooming myself to do a Marvel movie. That's not my
Right.
I don't. Well, I wasn't.
Who would have known to?
I wasn't weaned on those. But before you know it, you want to stay in some sort of game, and you're like, great, do some TV, keep doing the commercials. But then commercial business changes. That collapses. Every kid with a 5D is a director. And next thing you know, you're in your mid 50s. But it doesn't matter for me right now. I shoot stuff so cheap. I know it will look good. Go do a little 30-minute short film for $7,000 in 2 days. Two Alexa Minis, Alfie Allen, a girl from Riverdale. You just have to design these things around what you have.
Right.
Then you go make a big pilot, and it's $10 million pilot, and New York Teamsters, and they're sitting on their ass, and they move slow. And you're like, you're talking to a guy like Rudd Simmons, who's the line producer, done a lot of indie stuff. You're like, why are we moving so slow? Why is this? So, you know, it's the size of the trucks. You look at the transportation item on the budget, on the top line. You're like, let's get that down. So I think I work a lot because I like to shoot, but I also, like, don't want to, like, you know, like I said in my email to you, Hollywood doesn't give a shit about me, which is fine. You know, that boat sailed. So now I just want to keep making stuff and put enough money in the bank for my kid to go to college. And you leave behind a body of work, for better or for worse. You know, I mean, frankly, that's kind
of... Who can argue with that?
Right?
Yeah.
And all you got is your work and your friendships and your relationships. Yeah. So,
it's interesting how many... I mean, I sit here. It's like, I can't tell you how many projects I've worked on for, you know, a year. And, you know, you're working on some other thing at the same time, as a writer at least. But, yeah, and then just... And then the we were talking to Corman. Roger Corman came on... show a couple months ago, and he said something really interesting, true about, you know, how the amount of time it takes to make a deal now. He can go off and just shoot a couple of movies in that period. Everything,
sure, of course,
it's all slow now. The deal making process is
this is a lot of money.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things on the line, and you certainly don't want to rush in
right
to something that might turn out to be a money loser.
Yeah,
so you have to take yourself a little time. And so it helps if you can do something in the interim, like mow lawns, or
go to college, get a law degree,
start a religion, something.
I started a podcast studio at the time. I mean,
I stupidly or bravely made my last movie, and I just said, I'm going to make this movie. I'd done this Shirley MacLaine thing called The Last Word. We were finishing in April. I said, I want to make another movie this year. I want to pick that period of time between Thanksgiving and Christmas when nobody's working. I had an 18-day shoot. I hired the writer in April. We made the deal in 3 days. Pretty, you know, a guy named Alex Ross Perry. We got all the people. Within a week, he was in. 6 weeks later, he delivered it. And we got it, Vicky Thomas, to cast it.
Oh, lovely.
And within 3 days, we got John Hamm and Ellen Burstyn and Catherine Keener. Meanwhile, can't get it financed. We just keep going. You're like,
right.
And you realize you don't need to spend a lot of money to have a line producer, a location guy. You don't need to spend a lot. And you keep going. So my producer was like, all right, you're up to about 40K. You're up to 70K. Keep trying to sell it. Get some more names in it. And before you know it, you're up to maybe like 150 before we have to really start spending some money. So we had these budget levels of, like, we had one at 450, 7, and 9, depending who was going to be in it, depending on what we could sell. But, like, and at that point, my brother's in real estate in Baltimore. So, basically, you're looking for somebody to finance it, right? But they're basically loaning you the money. If you get enough of these names, you'll sell it to somebody, right? So I asked my friend, who's a sales guy, I said, how badly can I get burned? If I just loan my, like, how badly? He goes, if you can get two more decent names, you'll break even. It might take you 2 years, but you'll break even. And that's what happened. So you got to make the movie. Nobody told you what to do.
Right.
Which is another conversation, but I think it's actually good to not have Final Cut. I think it's actually good to have somebody that can keep you. I'm personally a better filmmaker having somebody leaning on me that has a little more commercial or narrative instincts than me.
Sure.
I just went through that on this Quibi thing, for even though it was a phone, it's still a movie. You're still making it as a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
It's broken into chapters, and it was this producer named Cary Grant. And I said,
oh, sure.
I have to thank you. We butted heads like motherfuckers, but I thanked him at the end. I said, you got the better version of me in this at the end of the day. You know, we're talking about with the composer, we're talking about theme. I was like, you don't have to beat the theme over people's heads. And the composer, to his credit, really heard my understanding of, instead of like, oh, it sounds like a weird David Lynch movie. It's like, come on, let's have a better aesthetic discussion than just being derisive like that. But he had to hear both of us, and he crushed it. You know what I mean? So that was a good creative experience, and that's fine, because in a commercial thing where you're getting, it's an assignment, right, it better work. You better listen to those people, you know, because...
That's how you get to come back.
In that world, yes.
Yeah.
You know, but it's all just changing so fast that, like, you got to be open to it and never just remain humble. And
well, no, I was saying to you, I was saying, by the way, our guest is Mark Pellington. For anyone who doesn't know this one, they know. They know.
Guy.
I was just saying, imagine calling your, you know, 25-year-old self up from today, calling him in the past and going,
don't do it.
I can't talk. I'm on a podcast.
Don't move from, oh, well, stay yeah. in New York.
I'm just saying, I'm talking on a podcast about doing a Quibi in Latvia, and how much of that would that kid understand? But
you know what? Well, when nobody actually, this is the first movie in the last 6 years. I've shot 3 movies in the last 5 years, and I shot them all here. Because if you just like design it around that way, and people are just leaving in droves, and it's very hard to get somebody to, you know, shoot.
Well, people
here.
Like to work here. Actors love to work here.
Yeah, they love it.
It's work. Work.
My friend
good.
Is writing something. I'm just writing something now with this guy. It's like. That I think you could get somebody to be in again, that multi-budget tier. And you know what? If you're not going to like producing, I like producing. I don't want to do the deliverables, which are a pain in the ass, right? But if you don't generate it yourself, like if you don't get it off the ground yourself, because nobody's knocking on the door saying, you know, making me offers. Right? So, I mean, once that boat sailed, so you got to generate your own stuff, right? So unless you're sitting there, I mean, like even Soderbergh goes to that. I saw him like 6 months ago. It's like, same shit. But he can call Merrill and say, hey, you want to do this thing?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? There's guys like that, but everybody struggles.
We have a mutual friend, and I see him about once every 10 years, and I had a conversation with Jim Cameron while he was in post on Avatar, which, you know, if people forget, he made after he made Titanic, which was, that did all right, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was just talking about the difficulties he was dealing with at the studio and getting the money he needed. I'm sitting there going, what are you, James Cameron has to, post Titanic, has to like go hat in hand to the studio to get a few extra pennies?
Well, he won't be able to go to that studio anymore.
Yes, who? No one can.
But I mean, but, it's changed. I mean, okay, yeah. So my friend, do you know Steve Moscow? He runs, used to run Sony TV, he runs Village Roadshow now. Mm-hmm. And he was like, he said, the next 18 months are really going to be the determining factor. I mean, how these streamers do, the rise of streamers. And I mean, it's, because some of them are going to fail. Some of them are going to fall on their ass, and there's going to have to be a correction to that. I don't know. I'm not in the tent pole business. I've never made one. Right. I don't, you know, great. I'm sure Jon Favreau is awesome. He's a great filmmaker. You know, we were talking about the thing, big ones and small ones. Yeah. Go make Chef. Go make these other ones. But I don't know. Like, if you're in the 99% of us, you know, like all of us, what do? You just... scrap along.
You keep slogging. Or you go on the movies that made me.
Yes.
Well, that'll take
which
up
we're
going
to have to cut all this because we never talk to our guests about their work. Yeah. So you've broken every rule of our very of our rigid, rigid guidelines, Mark. No, but you're going to come. You want to talk about some of your favorite filmmakers. Just trying to walk us through who made you who you are.
My favorite Bergman film is Honeymoon in Vegas. So I'm not going to lie and tell you that I'm some like, you know, which I just saw recently again and like laugh my ass off.
Really? Oh, okay. But
that doesn't influence me.
Is that in the Criterion box set? I haven't gotten to that one
yet. It's in the Andrew Bergman.
I was pulling the thread.
Oh, it's funny. When I sent you the first list of, okay, the people I liked, I liked what you said. Go deeper, more obscure.
Well, give us, because what we want to do is we want to sort of like, I guess the mandate is to, you know, there are some people listening to the show who haven't seen every movie ever made, and we want to try to point them to stuff that they might not.
Well, part of the value of the show, as we hear back from our listeners, is that we acquaint them with movies that they don't know about.
Go watch Demon Lover, Francois Ozon. You know, what I mean? Just like, but I only got into him like a year ago. I had seen Under the Sand. I was like, it was like about grief. But then I was like, just the variety of movies that he makes and how prolific he is. You know, it's like the guy's making movies all the time. Like, okay, what's up with the French? They just must have like a great thing, or they support it more. You know, so like, I love getting turned on to new people all the time. You know,
see, when you said
discovering Lover. People late. So I discovered Cassavetes early in my life, watched everything probably within a 1 month period. And that stuff just influences you in a way that like it gives you permission to say, keep going. When you see another, when you see an artist do something, you're like, God, I just want to do it like that. Yeah. It frees you up. Whether you're like, wow, I could, Mulholland Drive is cool, or Under the Skin is great, Jonathan Glazer, one of huge influence on me in that, like, you gotta have some plot, some degree of plot. Go watch The Great Beauty, go watch Under the Skin, some, so you can hang abstract themes in a story. Now, my brain, if I wrote it myself, it would be all just too abstract. It would be more right. Jodorowsky kind of thing, right? Okay, it's a pretty weird art movie, but if you have enough of a story, and I think that's why people are like, oh, what's the IP? Is it on a novel? Find an old novel that maybe has got some of these things. But I'm constantly, I didn't grow up as a cineast, as a cinephile. Like, oh, I watched Blondie and Dagwood movies with my father on a Sunday morning, and my mother took us to double features and would fall asleep. But back then, you'd go see... She'd go see some movie she wanted to see, and then Slapshot would be on after it, or Network, or Straw Dogs. So I'm 14 years old seeing Straw Dogs, and
oh shit!
I mean, I shouldn't be seeing that at like 13 or 14. This shit was blowing my mind. So I was like, grew up as a kid in water, a post in Watergate era. So I liked realism. I liked The Pawnbroker. I loved early Sidney Lumet movies because those were on TV. So I was never played Dungeons and Dragons and any of that crap. I hated Jethro Tull. So I hated fantasy. I never saw Star Wars. I just didn't. I didn't prescribe
really
to it.
Have you? No, I'm sorry. I did. I'm not one of those. I don't know. You know, it's fun. Did you ever get around to it?
No.
Because that's fantastic.
No. I like The Exorcist.
Because that is such a touchstone for the universe at this point.
Well, it's also in the business. That's a huge touchstone.
Well, yeah, that too. That too.
But I love Jaws.
I'm still. I'm still.
If Jodorowsky was around, he'd be doing Marvel movies.
He probably would be, wouldn't he? He is around. Isn't he around?
He's around physically.
He's around physically.
He's around in his 80s.
He's around his 80s. Yes. I would go to that. I would actually go to, you know.
But I mean, you know better. I mean, like any better than anybody. The cycles, right? So you can't go back to those cycles. So we can lament the 70s and lament these times, but what would we say in 15 years from now? Like, oh boy, those were the times you could just go. I don't know. There's no answer. The
time marches on.
Time marches on, and it better be on the page. Those are just two truisms.
Do you find, since we're talking about it, because I you know, I got here in the 80s, and I remember just this palpable sense, and I still, you know, the 70s for me are it, but there was this palpable sense that everything was crashing and burning, and the movies were all just turning into dopey kids movies and dumb IP and blah, blah, blah.
But in the 70s, there's also a big end of the world vibe. A Last Days of Man on Earth vibe.
Yeah. I mean,
there was a whole thing about, a lot of people believe this is the end times, and here's the...
Oh, no, I was sorry. I meant the quality of the film. I was just
the movies.
But now I look back at the 80s, and it's like, it's a pretty amazing decade. It just didn't feel like it.
I didn't even think about movies till the 90s, because I was cutting my teeth in...
He missed Just Say No.
...videos and promos and documentaries and art pieces and collages in New York. So it's like, I never did a short. I remember my friend Ted Hope, a producer, goes, you just need to make a short. Just get two people talking, get the basics of the film grammar. And so I think when I did my first movie in 96, I was like completely confused about screen direction and, you know, but you got to learn. You got to learn that first time.
But who were like, do you remember the first time like a movie just set you on fire that made you, you know, with the possibility?
Well, those early, like I said, the Straw Dogs and those movies at Network, which then would, it just said, wow, this is not my Blondie and Dagwood. This isn't the movies that my friends go, this isn't the world's greatest athlete or something that at age 11 you go to at kids' birthday parties. These aren't right. The things that are playing in the malls or the shopping centers in Baltimore. I was like, what is this? Like, this is weird and beautiful and great. So even then, let's say, what year was All the President's Men?
79,
78?
No, it's earlier than that.
Is it earlier? I thought it was 76. 77?
Right.
76? Yeah. When's the... I'm.
And Jaws was
well, post-Watergate.
75?
Because, yeah, Jaws is 75, and right. Network Jaws is 76.
Those
yeah,
were two, yep. Like, okay... Wow. Again, still, I was way more into music and journalism. Mm-hmm. I was like, I didn't go to the movies that much, so I didn't develop any interest in any visuals till I moved to New York. And I was sitting in edit rooms, be like, oh, what's that button do? So it would be like going to see a movie like Liquid Sky
oh, wow,
in
yeah.
1983, yeah, yeah. Some John Sayles, Brother from Another Planet, City of Hope. Like, those were the things early. Like, Jonathan Demme was and I got to meet Jonathan because his nephew Teddy was my PA at MTV. Mm-hmm. So, like, I really loved Jonathan's movies. Like, that was, like, a big thing. But you'd see Stop Making Sense, and then we'd go meet with Spalding Gray and maybe do something with him. So, it was never narrative-driven, plot-driven narratives were never my, like, oh my God, that's what I'm dying to make, you know? And so you fall into it, you make some of them, you like it. I like parts of that. I like working with actors, TV, but after I do something like that, I want to go do something more experimental and weirder and more fluid after that. And I just think I just finished the 70-minute dance film. And in the description, I say, well, Hollywood told me I can't make a movie about grief. And I realized it was just they told me I can't make a certain movie about grief. Maybe dance is a better platform to express that feeling. Because just, again, narrative, linear right. narrative is only one aspect.
But it's interesting, you were talking earlier about having somebody above you sort of cracking the whip a little bit and reining you in, don't you?
Which is good.
Yeah, no, but I think sort of one of the interesting things is, as you say, it's like Hollywood says you can't make a movie about this, so you have to, it creates a restriction whereby you have to figure out another way to make that movie.
You have to figure out another way to express yourself, and I like to think that, again, this kind of like life detour took me sideways, and I hope that, wow, we made 8 movies. People haven't seen a lot of them. Those are all good experiences. So I hope that my best films are ahead of me. Do you know what I mean? I hope right. that it's like that I can reach that promise of like, okay, and put them out there. So what I've learned about storytelling character, so somebody nudges and can get the best out of me. And that perfect example, that Quibi thing, you know, Quibi's a business. They wanted the big deals. They wanted, like, the hot shit people. They didn't want me to do it. They wanted somebody else to do it. And the producer and the writer fought for me. And I delivered for them. Correct. Right? So it's like, as an assignment, if you're going to play in that playground of commerce and it's only just endlessly, horribly, just endlessly about money now, I mean, just to a nauseating degree, where that's how we're judging these things. How much money it made, or the quantity, right. the quantification, you know, whatever it is. I don't know. Like, it's just, I just, like, Soderbergh's a hero of mine. There's people that are just, like, that inspire me, that are prolific, and it's like, I just want to keep doing that. You know what I mean? And I already, if I heard the word esoteric one more time from my manager last year, I was like, I had to go look it up. I was like, oh, okay. Right? I mean, but... You do what you do. You do what you do, right? You got your thing, so you have your fans, and you know I'm doing this class from an English university has been studying this like weird 50-minute music film I made 4 years ago. Like, I'm gonna do a Skype thing with them. That's fun. It's fun to give back and say, yeah, here you can think about stories this way. They don't all have to like. You don't have to. Use dialogue. No offense to screenwriter. Great screenwriter.
Well, we don't just write dialogue.
No, he writes the stuff that doesn't get on the
yeah,
screen.
Yeah, the stuff in between. Or the...
Do you know what I mean? Like, if just... I don't know.
Yeah. Yes.
Everybody's different, and you read a script, and you're like, great. Why do I want to do this? Why do I want to inhabit this? Does it speak to me? You know, when you're like, when you decide to do something, you just can't do something lightly. Even a TV pilot, I just can't take something. It's got to click on
something. If it doesn't speak to you, it isn't going to speak to you. You're not going to speak to it.
And challenges are like, go do, that's why I did those Star Trek things. Like, I'm not a sci-fi person at all. Alex Kurtzman was a big fan of a movie I did, Mothman Prophecies. And I was like, he goes, do you want to come do one of these things? One Michael Chabon had wrote, a little 12-minute thing. Then the other was an 8-minute silent, no dialogue, a totally silent story. I said, great. And I like Alex a lot. And it was nice to do something. I had some toys and tools, mm-hmm. you know, where you weren't just like, gun to your head, yeah. let's go. Which is,
but you gotta,
I don't mind shooting like that, but like, you can't, you just, that gets a little frustrating, you know, the running gun all the time.
I've been thinking all day about, because it is, yeah, you have to connect on some level. I had several years back, I got approached about writing Snowpiercer for, who's the guy who directed that?
That obscure kind of went, guy.
Yeah, I don't know whatever happened to that guy. But, you know, I was a huge fan of Bong Joon-ho's films. And I was like, oh my fucking God. Yeah. I was like, read the graphic novel. And I just couldn't. There's something about a thing where the metaphor, where there's no effort made to make the metaphor adhere to any kind of logic.
So it didn't connect with you.
And it just didn't. And which I'm just means, sitting there
which
going.
Is when you say, I'm not the right guy.
Yeah. And I did. And it not killed me because I would have killed to work with him. And the film they made entertained the living shit out of me. I think it's brilliant. And I was just like, and I watched the film, like, I couldn't have written that. But it's, yeah. Ugh.
Who wrote it?
Director Bong wrote it with another, they did, I believe it was a playwright here. I'm looking it up. I'm cheating. We'll cut and pause.
What have you not done because you couldn't wrap your head around it?
Hold on. I was a playwright named Kelly Masterson. Right. Wrote it with Director Bong.
Back when I was actually getting offers, I used to get offered pictures like the Flintstones, and I
passed on Flintstones 3.
I was very flattered to be offered it, but I said I'm not the right guy to make this picture. I don't really care for the Flintstones. To me, it's just a ripoff of the Honeymooners, and I never liked it. So you should get a guy who's got Flintstones soap in his bathtub.
Or vitamins.
And they did. They found a guy who was a huge Flintstones fan, and they made the movie and made Ryan a lot of money. LeVance. Everybody was happy.
Right, wasn't that his name?
Yeah.
Jesus. But don't you? There's some value too in coming into that not being a fan, where you can bring a.
Well, yeah,
but have
I
to
just,
still have a connection.
No, you have to have a connection. Yeah. And I had just worked with John Goodman, and I liked him. I'd love to work with him again, yeah. But not wearing loincloths, and you know, it just didn't. And,
yeah,
and I and it, it's the art direction is, you know, early.
I feel like you got more out of Goodman in Matinee than
Well, I think that was previous, but no, there are other things, and there was the first the Batman movie.
I think you got more out of him in Batman than they got out of him. I'm not sure how you get Batman more out of him in Flintstones.
Well, I was supposed to do the right after Gremlins was a big hit. They said, "Oh, let's have him do Batman," because Ivan Reitman had walked off it. And they were all ready to make it from Tom Mankiewicz's script. And
say John Mankiewicz?
Tom Mankiewicz. And it was very Bondian. And it was fine. But I was really excited about the Joker.
Right.
He was what I was interested in. I had John Lithgow. I was going to have him play the Joker, and it was going to be great. And then one night I woke up in the middle of the night, and I said, I can't do this. I'm the wrong guy. I don't believe in Batman. And so I went to the studio, and I told them that I didn't believe in Batman, and they practically called out, you know, the people with nets to take me away. He's like, you realize what you're doing? You realize this is what a big franchise this is? And I said, yeah, but if you're not going to like it and I'm not going to like it, then we're going to really be in big trouble. So I don't think I'm the right guy to do it. And I wasn't, as it turned out. And they didn't make that version of the picture. They went off and, you know, Tim made his own version. It was different.
Oh, God. I got approached vigorously about the first, Aaron Kruger speaking of, the first Transformers film. I'm like, the logic then, things have changed, was I had adapted a movie based on a graphic novel. Therefore, you should go to him for your, all your cartoon.
You're the graphic novel guy.
I'm the graphic novel cartoon specialist. Guy. So obviously I don't want to do Transformers. There's no point in going to that. I have no connection to that. And my agent went, oh God. And then 2 days later I called him up and I said, hey, I'm taking $1,500 to write a 10-minute Batman cartoon. and which he was very supportive of, but that's you know, I
150 bucks in it for
yeah, him. that's why Aaron Kruger owns a small island, and
yeah,
and you don't,
right? I'm here doing podcasts.
We're actually trying to develop Arlington Road as a TV thing right now. It's just like, hey, what would that idea be now? Mm. We're sitting there with Village Roadshow and talking about it. I said,
oh, in this world,
call Aaron.
Yeah,
Aaron, how would you like to revisit that world, adapt that world now?
Just but see, that's that the title. Whole thing with remakes. It seems to me that I'm not against remakes because some of the people's most beloved movies are actually remakes of other movies. But if you can't bring something from one era into another and find a new way to interpret it, and when Warren Beatty and Buck Henry made Heaven Can Wait.
Yes.
Out of Here Comes Mr. Jordan, mm-hmm. which is a perfectly good movie from right. the 1940s. And they updated it. They changed the sport from boxing to football. They made it's a terrific remake. You know, mm-hmm. it's a really great remake. And yeah. and the original is still great too.
Yep.
But it's like you can actually have that. But the trend is to let's just make the same movie over with different people in it. Let's yeah. do Psycho, like Gus Van Sant's version, which is shot for shot the same movie.
8 hour. Like Jack Ryan. Do you watch? Have you seen the Jack Ryan show on Amazon?
I don't.
I have not seen.
I love the ones that Harrison was. I mean, I like that whole franchise.
Yeah.
And now I've enjoyed two seasons because it's basically an 8 hour movie. There's a much huge,
which you can now
sprawling
do.
Arc.
Yeah.
You know, really big conspiracy. A big, you know, Krasinski's not Harrison Ford, but that's fine. Like he's a lot of people have played that.
Or Alec
guy.
Baldwin.
Or Baldwin.
Or Nick
Cage.
That is why. Did Nick Cage play?
No, but he's got his own island, and where we?
Oh.
We haven't
sorry,
talked about Mandy yet. So
word, yes, we're on topic here. Right. Give me another filmmaker, Mark. Come on, tell me, someone who sets you on fire, someone who one of your.
I probably across the board, I would say Paul Thomas Anderson movies have left. I've left the theater more energized and blown Man. Away and inspired. Four times, and I've seen them all in the theater. Now, the only one I didn't see in the theater was Phantom Thread, and it left me, and I saw it at home, and it didn't. Now, was that because I watched it at home or because, I don't know, but literally Magnolia, Boogie Nights, The Master, and There Will Be Blood just left like, yes, keep on your path, do the thing. No one would ever put me in anywhere in comparison to him or anybody, but just it inspired me to the humanity that he, you know, the mastery filmmaking wise, the emotional depth of the characters, mm-hmm. the range of just the tonal command. I just fucking loved it. I was like moved, and especially Magnolia, especially where long time ago, right?
Yeah.
So more and more,
but not fair.
Last year, The Mustang did that for me.
The Mustang's a good picture.
Oh, Mustang's
great.
Perfect,
where I left, I was like, wow. Now part of it was Jed Kurzel's score and the cinematography. Just like I find myself not moved by as many films as I would hope to.
But I mean, because Joe, you're not a Phantom Thread guy either.
Right? Well, I just thought it was a long episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
I don't.
The wrap up is, I just didn't find very believable or satisfying.
I'm kind of hit and miss with him, and the ones I love are, I mean, obviously Boogie Nights, but Inherent Vice and Phantom Thread were the ones that really knocked me out. And they're both looking at me like I'm.
No.
But I went kicking and screaming.
Different strokes
the Phantom
for different
because I thought,
yeah.
I know you could sort of feel the Paul Thomas Anderson films that are going to call my name, and that didn't seem to be one. And I don't even know how I ended up. And I was just like, holy. I mean,
you don't know when.
Yeah.
Nor should
what
you.
What you're looking for.
Exactly. Yes.
It's just got to hit you. You got. It's a relationship between you and the film. Not even between you and the filmmaker. It's between you and the film.
Yeah. Keep going and see. Like I remember meeting Terry Malick and met him through his agent at CAA at the time, Rick Hess, or Rick knew him and met him. And my friend Hank Corwin was cutting New World. And he goes, hey, come, we're going to go sit with the music editor. I spent 3 hours with him one time and saw him move James Horner's cues all over the place with three cues over three different scenes with a music editor. And like, here, move it here, move it there. Like driving the music editor crazy. So I know, well, James said it should go here. He goes, yeah, I understand what James said, but put it here. And the way that like the cello comes in when it's like, it's not when you expect it. I mean, that right there was the biggest, to this day, the biggest influence of me, seeing the malleability of how you can, yes, where you spot it, but you're spotting on, when you're spotting something, it's a different axis of your brain. Like, great. So then the composer's going to make his piece, but like, well, but, and so what? It's not science. It's like, move it right over here. What happens?
What happens?
Maybe it's
your
mistake.
It. Yeah.
I've put cues in before, just move it back 15 seconds and sat back and for 3 minutes just been like, fell off the truck. I mean, like, literally, and it's perfect. And just say, great, that's where it's going to go. Well, it doesn't matter. You're just, it's, you just, you feel something. You have to go by your intuition. So
yeah,
if you see movies that feel like they're being not made by a system, Diving Bell and the Butterfly, you're just like, fuck, just like the humanity is seeping through that and the artistry is seeping through that. And those are the kind of movies that, like, inspire me.
Yeah.
You know, but then I could go watch an incredibly simple, beautifully constructed Sidney Lumet movie and be like, that I love because it's simple. And even though I was could never have made anything like that then, now if I put down, I remember on this film I did The Last Word with Philip Baker Hall and Shirley MacLaine, I just did the scene and it worked on the page. They were two masters. They crushed it. And you're like, okay, what was difficult about that? I didn't do anything. As a director, I just stayed out of the way.
Right.
And then you can look at your films and see where you're like, oh, yeah, I was probably propping up something where the character was weak on the page, or this was a fable, but I was inconsistent in tone. I made three comedy dramas. I'm like, I'm not making anymore. I'm not Hal Ashby. I will never be Hal Ashby. It's just like, whatever you think that you can do, you realize how difficult that is to really blend those tones. Yeah. You know, the comedic, just like we're like, so you look at the people that do it wonderfully, and I'm like, okay, was that because they're the writer director? Is that because they know that voice? Then, so I feel that, and then I go do a pilot that Michelle Ashford, who created Masters of Sex, did, right? And it was a version of Cocaine Cowboys, right? But not the violent one. It was Elmore Leonard in tone. It was more Tarantino or Elmore Leonard. And I was like, that tone I got. I understood. Yeah. For whatever it was, I could handle that blend of comedy and action, and don't even know what the word is. It just, I felt more natural giving direction to actors in that movie than another one. So, yeah. You know, but you have to also know your limitations. Know what you're like. Let somebody else make those.
Yeah. So,
right? Yep, and if you go write a, wouldn't you like to go just write a pure love story and nothing to do at
me?
All?
Yeah. No.
Why?
Because someone's got to get killed in it. It's like, I've got my baby, my passion script of all the adapted a Dennis Lehane short story, and it is a great love story in there, mm-hmm. but a lot of shooting as well. It's I'm a genre guy. it's got I don't know what was
do you like violence
in my personal life?
No, but as a writer, like, you feel more, you just feel comfortable in that.
No, there's something about it that's primal and interesting that gets you to places. One of the things I love, and it's with History of Violence, we have, I think, 2 minutes of violence in the whole film.
Yep.
But people assume we had a lot of trouble getting women into the theaters because of that. But I judiciously used, yes, I do.
Who's the old noir writer? Geddes?
Yeah, David Geddes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like his work?
Yeah, I haven't read him in a long time. What's the like the burglar? Goodness,
yeah.
Smack me in the face.
The burglar, because somebody was like telling me that I should option that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, there's a
God. There's a movie. 1956.
Yeah, there was a movie with
Dan Duryea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so, what about like adapting or modernizing movies like that? What do you think about that?
That's fun. That is fun. I definitely enjoy that stuff. I mean, film noir is...
You just got to remember there are cell phones now.
Yeah. So, by the way, can we talk? Can we do 2 minutes on the death of cinema via cell phone? And I don't mean people watching them. It is the most infuriating aspect of any story you want to tell now is cell phones. It's, you have to come up with ways to get around freaking cell phones.
Oh, no service out here.
Oh, my God. That is, yeah. What's the Harrison Ford movie with Michelle, What Lies Beneath? I remember there's a scene 10 minutes of the movie, they're driving across a bridge and she's in the car and it's looped in. And it's like, gosh darn it, the signal always goes out just as I cross this bridge. And I'm like, guess who's getting attacked by a maniac on the bridge in the third act?
Okay, the little Quibi thing, made yeah. for phones.
Yes.
So with Quibi, you take them your script and break it into 12, 10-minute chapters.
An existing right? script.
Right.
So I read the script the first 5 times without any episode breaks. They're like, oh, do you want to read the Quibi version? I'm like, okay. And it was just every 9 minutes something happened. So you have to kind of customize it.
Right.
Plane crash, girl who wants to kill herself on the plane. Plane bumps, pills go all over the place, plane crashes. She and one other kid live. So she has to survive. So the girl who wants to die has to learn how to survive. And the first thing we said is, boy, their phones get destroyed.
Yeah.
Because like, have to. We're going to, what? Because they're like, well, should one of the phones be, and maybe they use that as a torch. I'm like, they're out. They're gone. Yeah. They can't find them. They're disappeared. Let's just wipe that off the table. And it was so freeing.
What would the history of storytelling be like? What would Edgar Allan Poe or Charles Dickens be like if you could have a cell phone? You know, it's just, that's the difference.
Imagine the telltale heart if the guy behind the wall had a cell phone.
We're now, this is the future. We're in the future. We're living in the future.
I just saw, like, I don't know, before I went away to Europe, I saw like 3 movies in a row. It was like, that dopey one with Adam Devine that was like looked like the stupid version of Her, where he's having a relationship with his
Ex-Machina. Oh, right, yeah.
No,
yeah.
No, God, I would not Ex-Machina. Right?
Yeah.
Simone?
Something, yes.
I'm just trying to think of all the female robot movies.
Call it
Axe or something. Yes. But it was like, I'm looking at it, then there was another trailer. It was like, half of it was like people on their phones. And and you're just like, garbage. So if they're writing these scripts, great. I mean, look, Her was a brilliant film about technology and our reliance.
Or you can do we do this every week. We can't remember the things. The John Cho movie that's entirely searching. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is what
entirely seen on your computer screen, on a computer screen.
But here's what's interesting, the Quibi thing that's interesting. Yeah. So you have a vertical, you have a horizontal frame and a vertical.
Oh,
frame.
Right. You have to shoot for both.
Right.
No.
No, because no. So our movie in the mountains, we shot 2:1. Right. So
right.
Big film, and then you have to make the vertical version.
That's what I'm saying. Right. I just said that.
In retrospect,
yes, you have to shoot.
What you'd have to do, you'd have to shoot it square to protect the movie. But do you really want to go shoot in the Alps because you're making the movie? So at this point, you're selling the thing internationally as a film. Correct. So you have to have at least 185. Right. So when you go like that, it's great for talking heads, but it gets compromised unless you're really going to get into split screens.
Yeah. Why can't you just turn the phone on its side and watch it?
You can.
Oh, you can.
But you also have the technology when you go like that, because a lot of people, more people watch their things like this.
Well, and fuck them.
But they traditionally have been watching it with just like this.
Well, I'm so
sorry.
So,
for the record, Adam Devine, Harrison Ford not coming on the show. Joe not working the world.
So here it is. No, this is an interesting idea. So now you can tell a story. Soderbergh's producing one for these young guys that Ty Sheridan is in, right? One, the horizontal story is about a guy, his cell phone's dying, and he's trying to make these calls. This version is what the other people are on the other line. It's 2 different movies.
Also, when you flip it,
when you flip it, it becomes who he's talking to. It's it's one locked audio track. So now the technology, they haven't figured out for it to be, because it'd be 2 different movies. So the audio track's the same. So you have to cut, in our thing, you cut this version. So you have to do the vertical version. And you tell the editor, great, you don't frame. We didn't frame 2, 3, 5, put people way on the left of frame. Because you don't want to make it a horrible, horrible experience. But we knew, I shot for the movie, talked to Antoine Fuqua, who I knew before he shot, when he goes, screw it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you gotta go as a filmmaker for what the big picture is. And in a very talking head kind of movie, it's acceptable. But if you're getting the big drone helicopter shots, you have to accept the compromise. But that is, unfortunately, that's how many, many people are seeing. I just hope that they watch it horizontally. I would love to. If somebody said, go shoot a movie vertically and shoot it that way, that'd be a great challenge. Go shoot a movie in a city. Fantastic.
But the idea of doing
scenes indoors. Like,
both. Wow.
Yeah, so they're not giving you double the budget or double the editing time.
Right.
Right. Right. Double the work.
Yeah, double the product.
Is it a new business model?
I saw a lot of commercials for these on just over
people
the last
watch week. Netflix yeah. movies. People watch movies on their phone all the time. Yeah. Right? I mean, just great. Do you want to watch it on your phone or do you want to go to the theater? So you can't fight it, right? But I still tell stories. I've been making music videos for 30 years.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember 8 years ago I wanted to do a quad, 4-way split, and they're like, if you do it on the phone, it's going to be too much. People aren't going to be able to follow it on the phone. I don't know. So what are you making it for?
That's not, one of the things I love about Soderbergh is his eagerness to kind of play around. I mean, I loved Mosaic. I watched it on the app, the 8-hour version that you would thread your way through instead of the...
Great.
And it sounds... Yeah, that's exactly what he would do.
Did you see the picture when he did... what was it? The one that the Moonlight writer wrote about the basketball thing with...
High Flying Bird.
Right. Do you see the picture of him, the production still of him?
Yeah, with a...
This on the tripod, and he's sitting on
his iPhone on a tripod, yeah. Yeah. Or you wanted to talk, too, about Sean Baker. Talk about shooting photos on an iPhone. That was... Tangerine's an amazing...
Because it's just so free. Because he said... I remember, it was just like, you have to make the movie. You have to make the movie by hook or by crook. So what is that? At that time, that's the technology. I shot a movie... in 2010 on the 5D. Cost $600,000 to get in the can up in Big Sur. Just don't make a movie about four guys that kill themselves. That's got limited commercial appeal. But it was like, I wanted to make it. Got the actors in a month. We shot it. Looks beautiful. Put the camera on helicopters, car mounts. It would take 10 minutes instead of 2 hours. That's so much better than taking 2 hours on a fucking process trailer. I mean, like,
and
sorry,
they get the same angle all the time.
And that's a waste of, that's, process trailers are garbage, right? I mean, how many great, stick it here, have the camera come along, go on, what's that movie, The Raid? Like, you just see the making of, like, the way Greengrass does it. Like, I remember I did a pilot one time and would listen to Greengrass's DVD commentaries, and then the stunt coordinator says, you gotta watch a South Korean movie called Suspect, like, makes Greengrass look like
static,
like everything's on sticks.
Yeah, like Peter Greenaway, and just like, this thing was the most radical, super inspiring. You know, just like, great, like it was relentless, it was reckless. Extras, they must pay him 5 cents a day, just like people getting mowed over by cars. Great, bring in 1,000 more. So I don't, like that stuff. Like that inspires me. You know, and I learned in that one how you have to keep in a thriller, you have to keep the relentless tone with the camera operators and the actors. If you think like, oh, it's a harrowing, tense thing, you have to beat them up on the shoot, right? You have to like keep moving, and like that only came from experience and some stuff that Greengrass said. He goes, you have to like, you know, the operators say, let's just, because everybody will get lazy. The actors will be like, okay, you know, especially in TV, you know, you got to just fucking crack the whip in order for it to feel scary.
So you listen to commentaries of filmmakers you like on
all
on,
the time.
Yeah, fantastic.
All the time. Like, I feel like that was kind of a film school, and like Fincher, you know, who I know David, but he's still like just such a fucking master, and just like where he puts the camera, you're just like, God, and then I just went down and saw him shoot Mank, because my friend who he hired for Mindhunters is shooting it. Yeah. Sit there and like pick Eric Roth's brain, who was writing the script. It's like, but you sit there and David's just like giving Gary Oldman direction. That's who you see in like take 31, just like, and it's just like, and he's looking at the take and he's like, God, I got fucking like yelling at the operators, yelling at like. can that guy fucking pull focus? And you just realize it's like the same frustration. You're just trying to get the shot. Oldman would go over, say something, and you'd see, like, I wonder what to... And I couldn't follow him over and really, because that's where you really want to learn.
Right, like, the whispers.
Yeah, what does he say? What does he say to Gary Oldman to get, like, something different? And I said, doesn't Gary Oldman get tired after 30 takes? I mean, and he goes, no. So that's what I wanted to know. Like, how can an actor not just feel, like, a little bit worn after doing that many...
Right.
That many takes?
Well, I'm
it's nice to be able to have that time to do it, right? I mean, if you were like...
If you're Kubrick, you get away with it.
Yeah.
But Kubrick also worked with a really small crew, right? Smaller crew, more days. How can you do that? I think if you design it the right way. Mm-hmm. I love, and I do this a lot of times in commercials, and I've just started to do it more in movies. I just walk into real locations and don't touch it. I don't want to come into like a recording studio for guys doing a... Here it is, done.
Right.
Like, how little do I have to do to a place? And because it's never going to look as good, you empty the place and bring in the shelves. No, that maybe another movie is a totally different experience. But, you know, when you go see sets, of, like I did a pilot one time with Mark Friedberg, who's like just, he just did Joker. I mean, an incredible production designer. You know, I mean, just, I love when you see production designers get to do their thing. But as long as you know you can do it, the worst is when you have that champagne taste and you got, Yoo-hoo money and you're like pulling your exactly. fucking hair out, right?
Exactly.
Like, so I think that's probably what I've learned is like, just know what the budget is, and the budget is the aesthetic. That's what my old friend Ted Hope said. You know, like they made those early on, Good Machine made those movies. Just, but the thing I've learned in videos and commercials over the years, like I know it will look good. The last thing I'm worried about is it looking interesting, because we know what we can do in color correction. You can do it now on this.
Right on your phone.
But it's just like the page, and that's what I'm trying to get better at and smarter at, is like not just really make sure. I don't want to make another movie until it's like a slam dunk on the page.
You know? Not a bad philosophy. What so for some
like
of our
you to look at it.
Hey, I think
he will not read your fucking script.
You don't need read. You don't need writers to read your.
Who should read? Who should read your scripts to see if they're ready or not?
Your writer friends. Yes, I thought. But if it's completely done, already
you know
there.
Henry Bean.
I know of. Yes,
my friend Henry Bean and Larry Gross just wrote an incredible TV show. Larry wrote a script, rewrote a script for me that I've been trying to get made for 20 years. That I'd hired Paul Schrader to do the first draft of years ago, and Paul. Paul didn't really deliver. Paul gave me a 70-page first draft and said, this thing is so in your head, I'm gonna give this to you as a working document. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But, like, I don't know. I send Larry and different writer friends my scripts that I want to make, and they're pretty – it's good because they're really brutal. They do not.
Yeah, no, that's an essential thing.
You're getting ready to shoot, and they're like, ah, this needs a lot of work. You're like, oh, we're shooting in 2 weeks.
Yes, you need people who will be harsh. Or if, you know, just fair. But so fair. Who are some of the, because, you know, I think some of our listeners are, you know, struggling or aspiring or chugging along their way to becoming filmmakers. And there's an awful lot of these out there. Like, who are some of the commentary tracks you've heard that you found most, if you can think of a few of those.
You mean when they used to make DVDs with commentary?
Yeah, well, they still do.
They still do.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I don't know if there was...
Not as much, or not in art house movies, they don't automatically...
But even old, like One False Move with Carl Franklin, to me, was like 90 minutes of film school.
Okay.
It's an incredible commentary. But you know, I'm a screenwriter. You're a director. Like, who is...
Ridley Scott.
Yep.
Ridley Scott, I think I've watched his commentary on... almost all of his movies. I mean, especially like a movie like The Counselor, which people like bash, but I loved that fucking movie. I thought that movie was like amazing.
Okay, let's slow down here for a minute, because we very few of us on the planet, and when we find each other,
you know.
Now, which do you prefer, the director's cut or the theatrical cut?
Oh God, I only saw the director's cut. I never saw the theatrical.
Okay, because I the director's cut is funnier. you're in the movie theater, and there's a sort of question of like, do they know what's going on here? And then you see the director's cut, and it's like, oh, they know what's going on here.
He's just gotten so like he's so risky. And Tony Scott I loved Tony Scott, and also you look like give him a kind of flimsy script, he'll do his shit. And be like, all right, or Unstoppable or Domino, but give him Man on Fire. Like, so you give him a great script, incredible.
Yeah.
He's great with, and he casts it well, and he does his thing. So the Scott brothers, as shooters, I really like them.
But Ridley gets into it on the commentaries. He gets into the, like, that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like he's teaching you. Greengrass was the same way, where some people, like I was listening. That wasn't on a commentary track, but like Noah Baumbach was talking about the prelude that he wrote. Because probably I'm trying to write more, have the confidence to write more. So it's really like trying to listen to writers. And I was in Jerry Maguire years ago, so Cameron Crowe's been a real friend. And I called him yesterday and I said, can I get your advice about this music-based project that I want to write? And he's like, you got to write it. And it really came down to like something personal. What's your personal connection to this music? And then there you go in the Oscars, and it's like the more personal the better. And that was a very profound comment, you know what I mean? Just like, okay, trust that instinct. You know what I mean? My best videos have been personal. The best stuff is you can find yourself in it, and even if it's an invisible allegory, it's in there, and you know what the story is that you're telling, good, bad, or indifferent, right. So like people's failures, I think, like that movie was considered a failure for Ridley Scott. It's like
huge.
Failures are like, I think it's like interesting.
It's probably my favorite Ridley Scott film since, I don't know, Thelma and Louise.
Well, don't you have a commentary on, speaking of failures,
on Counselor?
On the Oscar?
Oh, yeah. No, I do. Yes.
The 1966 version of the Oscar.
Oh, I don't know that.
A legendary bad film.
Written by my dear friend, the late lamented Harlan Ellison.
Okay.
It was his one big screenplay credit. Did a lot of great TV. And yeah, we recently did Kino.
It's just come out.
Gorgeous Blu-ray of it. And they did a commentary track with myself, Patton Oswalt, and Eric Nelson, who directed the documentary about Harlan. And we basically sit there with Harlan's wife in the room watching and laughing, and we drink and we bounce back and forth between making fun of the movie and actually discussing his 300-page screenplay and how well or badly it translated to film. But I like to think there's a few tidbits for writers in that. Mostly it's drinking and laughing.
Did you ever read The Moviegoer?
Walker Percy.
Oh, the Walker Percy. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because I was just reading about that, and I just ordered the book.
Oh, no, you'll like it.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And then I read that Malick tried to make it in the 80s.
It's been one of those many legendary, hands. I can make a movie out of it.
Like The Dice Man?
Yeah.
The Dice
those,
Man, yes.
One of those things that people think they can do, and then they discover it's harder than they thought.
Yeah.
Yep. I was just reading a review of the Dee Reese edit. She did the Joan Didion thing. I was reading some like big New York Times thing about her, and like I guess she got creamed by critics. Like, we've all been creamed by critics at Sundance, but they're just how difficult it is to adapt Joan Didion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
my first movie was adapted from a book by a guy named Dan Wakefield called Going All the Way, which was like a Midwestern Catcher in the Rye, set in 1954.
Right.
Big, like, very popular book in the 70s. Ben Affleck, Jeremy Davies, Rachel Weisz, Rose McGowan. And, like, will never touch the beauty and the interior, the interior nature of the novel. You know, like,
yeah, but that's true. So that's the Catcher in the Rye thing, you know? I mean, it's not just that he didn't want people to make it. But he knew what it would be like if they did.
Yeah.
Some things need to be books.
Have you think there's been a successful adaptation of a
difficult book?
Difficult book.
I think Being There is pretty damn good.
I
read the book, I thought, gee, this is so slight. How are they going to make a whole movie out of this?
So maybe it's finding the slight ones.
Well, maybe, you know, short stories make great
short stories for sure. Under the Volcano worked. Yeah. I mean, that was...
Is that Shanley?
Under the Volcano? I don't think so. Houston did it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he directed it. Yeah, I think he adapted it as well.
Joe and the Volcano was...
Yeah.
Joe versus the Volcano, yes. Which
is a very strange and interesting movie.
Yes.
With several different endings, most of which were never seen by the audience.
He was attached. I was trying to get this book. I got to spend some time with him, and he was attached. We were trying to go sell him to write the screenplay of a book by the woman who had written Pay It Forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her follow-up novel called Electric God. Great title. Nick Cage was attached. Couldn't get arrested. It was as these, like, Cider House Rules. It was after Cider House Rules, but it was like the shipping news and a few of these big literary things were just...
Well, with those two titles, I mean, how are you going to sell those pictures? You know, Cider House, like, Rules and the Shipping News?
Cider House Rules was
If you don't already know, it's a big book, and then nobody's going to go.
Cider House Rules was successful, but Shipping News wasn't. And there was, like, a few other right after it were, like, these big books that just were, like...
Yeah.
My agents were always after me to, like... I don't know. I can't think of any more commentaries. Like, I'd have to
go but, I don't think
and
I've
look
ever...
through my DVD...
Yeah, I didn't even. I need to listen to Ridley Scott's *On the Counselor* because I'm sort of obsessed with that film. And
he's just keeps going. He just keeps going. He's pretty prolific. He doesn't stop. You know, and I love the balls of him when he put Plummer in, and they're like, "Oh, what's gonna happen?" And he's like,
and "He did it a week or something,
it.
Right?"
That was
he's like, "Let's go."
That was a decision.
He goes, yeah, "I'll show you. I can fucking do it. I'm gonna go shoot it. And I'm gonna mix it. And I got my team and I got my guys. And yeah, we know how to do it." I just love that kind of like can do attitude. You know?
I wonder how motivated he'd have been to do that if Plummer was his first choice, right?
Wasn't yeah,
that the, yeah, like if so it was your
but
opportunity,
but he wasn't available,
right? But I mean, imagine.
And then it's like, oh, now I have to get rid of this other guy.
Yeah.
Who, from the trailer, looks like he was miscast anyway.
Yeah.
So it was a win-win for the movie.
I'm sorry. I feel like he was highly motivated in that situation in a way that maybe if he had loved Kevin Spacey in the film and had been his first choice, he might not have been able to bag it
even,
out in a week.
Even the makeup doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember.
I just remember seeing the trailer and going, oh, no, that's not believable.
I didn't love the film. I didn't get to see Danny Boyle's limited series.
Oh, it was pretty interesting. I liked it better than the film. It had its problems, but Sutherland is absolutely incredible.
Oh, Hearst. God.
Yes.
I'd love to work with him.
Yeah.
I worked with Alan Bates on a movie, and they're just these guys like Sutherland. You're just like, you know, you don't have to tell him much, right?
Have you read the script?
Yeah. Like, okay. Would you like to do another one? Would you?
What happens when you get up to 31?
Yeah. But they all, I don't know. Do they want to be directed? Do all actors want to be directed? Or do all just want to be like, come in and do it? And
all actors are different. And all situations are different.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
And there is that thing. I mean, I've been forming, every writer has, hopefully, who's achieved a certain level. But that moment when a great actor takes something that you've never told anybody on the project you know isn't quite there, and then just knocks it out of the park, and you're standing there going, holy shit, this is good. Who wrote it? And you're like, oh my God, that's my terrible monologue.
That's very interesting.
That is the greatest feeling in the world, I think.
I just did this little short with Alfie Allen from Game of Thrones and this young ingenue. It was like a calculated thing. Like, I want to do this short, but maybe somebody will see it if you put some young names in it. And I had Peter Bogdanovich do a cameo. That's just kind of, and so he's reading some of my voiceover stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, he's gonna tell me, like, if it sucks or not. And he would read one thing, he goes, yeah, that's okay. Like, it was really good. It was really good to have his critical eye. He had slowed down. I think something had. Anyway, but just what a great voice. What a great. Great presence. He added a great spice to it.
Yeah, that's that extra thing that you can't
and then,
control.
So I had some other stuff to do for it, and I found this voiceover guy. This is an actor, and he's had this incredible voice, like the most incredible gravelly sci-fi. And so I'm also, he's reading my thing, and I'm like, wow, he made it work.
Yeah.
You know, whereas like, I would read it or somebody else would, the guy before had read it, and I'm like, God, that's such a fucking horrible writing or just terrible, pretentious shit. And then the other guy's like, I don't know. So do you find that, like, people, that same thing? Like, is it the words or is it the mouthpiece?
Oh, no, it's I'm talking about, like, when the performance comes in and they find something, they find the shape of it that you were chasing after and couldn't find, or they bring something to it entirely new that you go, oh, thank God, there was nothing, you know, it's, because everything suggests something different to somebody else.
Yeah, Philip Baker Hall and Shirley on this
talking about a great
did.
Voice.
Yeah.
They did that, and they took some of this in the... And I found, and it was also happened on this last thing I just did, it was all deletion. Deletion, deletion, deletion. It was like, how much could they strip it down?
Oh, that's fun, too.
You know, and one of them was a little overwritten. The Quibi one was like, it was a YA thing, but the people were older, and like, they're on a plane, and like, they're not going to talk that much. Their plane just crashed. They're traumatized. They would not be talking this much. But which was really good because it was very reductive and it really helped you just boil it down to
I will
the basics.
Tell the story and leave a name out because it works. And I just lovely. But one of my early straight-to-video films was an actor who the lead had originally been designed for somebody older and a good, you know, a much more solid actor. And this is a young guy. And it was like, how do we tell him that I'm going to slash a whole bunch of his lines without getting him upset? And I found the great, you tell him about Clint Eastwood on Fistful of Dollars. It's like, you know why Clint's a movie star? I'm like, no, well, I mean, he's like, no, he's a movie star because that initial script was, what, 180 pages or something? And Clint went through and slashed 90% of his lines because he knew it was about his presence. And you tell him that, and they go, oh, I go, now I'm going to go cut 90% of your lines. And they're like, oh, fantastic. Because I think at the end of the day, even today, with all the issues, everybody still wants to be Clint Eastwood.
Yeah,
but you want
he does.
Voices. Have you heard Walter's? Walter Hill has just ventured into the world of audio. Not on this show yet. Goddamn, I am still working on getting him. And he wrote this lovely, I don't even know how to describe it, sort of a tone poem. It's called Cowboy Iliad. I think you can get it on CD. I know you can get it on things like iTunes and so forth. And it's him telling this great story about a cowboy shootout in the Old West. And Walter, who's got one of the great, like, Old West voices, narrates it. And you're just listening to it, and you're like, oh, my God, this is phenomenal. And, you know, if it was me reading it or something like that, you go, oh, that's okay. But coming from Walter's kind of gravelly old
Has
cowboy.
He been on your show?
We are. I've been nagging him for about 3 years.
It's only the second season.
He's good friends
third,
with.
We're in our third season.
He and Larry Gross are good friends.
Oh no, he's a really good. We have the same birthday, and which always thrilled me as a kid because he was one of my favorite filmmakers. And cut 2 years later, we worked on a thing together that didn't happen. And now every year on our mutual birthday, you'll find us at Musso and Frank's, where I'm usually spending 10 minutes nagging him to come on the show, which I swear he will. I swear he will.
Is he still giving a shot to make movies?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Still chugging away. A great voice is everything. I think it's...
Absolutely.
And as much as we bag on the dearth of those things, you know, you talk about like Cagney and, you know, you hear him and you know it's Cagney. I actually heard somebody do a Brad Pitt impression the other day that just changed my entire perspective of Brad Pitt because you knew 10 seconds into it that it was Brad Pitt and you never think of Brad Pitt as having one of those distinct voices.
Did you like Ad Astra?
I'll say yes, even though I haven't actually seen it yet. I'm sure I will.
Did you see it?
I haven't seen it, no, but I don't feel the need to lie about it.
I don't know. We do a show about movies.
Don't worry,
we're
James,
the business.
James Gray won't yell at you.
I like James Gray a great deal. Just have for now. Why didn't they send screeners out? Let's get inside baseball. Why were there no Ad Astra screeners?
Really good to see on a big screen.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Title.
Very meditative. Very meditative. Title?
Ad Astra?
Oh yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Was it Sam Markoff with Suicide Kings? What was his great line? He's like, you can't use that title. No one's going to go see it.
It wasn't Suicide Kings.
Was it Suicide Kings?
No, it's not a real story. It's not a real movie.
No, it's a real movie.
Not a Markoff movie.
No. It was just he commented on it. That movie's not going to make any money because of the title. That alone.
So who's making all the movies now that the studios aren't making anymore? I make 10 a year.
There's a billion of them on my Apple TV. And you are,
I've never made a Netflix movie. My movies I'm not in the algorithm.
Sooner or later.
Like, you kill the hero, gone, they kill themselves.
We're all going to be working for Netflix.
Yeah. I'm doing one right now, so.
To stream. But my friends who have made them said they totally leave you alone.
Yep.
They do, but apparently the process of getting it made is pretty rigorous and going up the ladder and making sure that everything's okay. Once it's okay and greenlit, they tend to leave you alone. But the process of getting there is not easy. They don't just like, here's some money, boy.
Well, movie and I'll come back. Give my lament for the death of physical media and, you know, just like, I just can't go to meetings without like, okay, here's my USB, here's my reel, here's my fake, you know, it's just like, it's at least something I can still physically, like, I can't, like, sending links, I feel just like it's very, you know, and I know I'm pissing against the wind, but like, it's just, you know, it's very frustrating. I used to love making DVDs and, you know, custom reels, and it's somebody to, you know, I'm not sure they're going to watch a link. You know, you don't.
Yeah, I miss physical media. Although they still make it.
They still make physical media, and then you better hold on to it, because when Disney takes it all out of circulation, puts it in the vault.
You really have to. It relies on your team. Like, say with this new thing that I just made, to get your team to set up screening. I mean, you want people to see your work. The bottom line is this: so you want to do a movie that's in theaters for 2 weekends is very frustrating and gets shit distribution around the world. So, like, how do you get your, Netflix? I can see jumping on that train, millions and millions of people get to see your story.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But they can't put it in their library.
Yeah.
Mark, we've got a couple minutes left. I'm going to put it to you. We have a bunch of audience members, I think, even 2 people in the Maldives. Right now, Maldives. I don't know. I look at the
numbers. Maldives.
Yeah, I've never been, but there's 2 people in the Maldives.
Good morning, Maldives.
give us a movie that you love that you wish more people knew about that
isn't yours.
That isn't yours. Yes.
Oh God. A movie that I love that I wish more people knew about. Okay. It's not high cinema.
You're not going to be judged.
Doesn't matter.
It's not about you. It's about
a movie that Jake Kasdan did called The TV Set, which is a parody. It's The Player for TV pilots.
That's right.
Yeah. And it is the funniest, most brilliant skewering of the mindset of the creation of a TV pilot. Sigourney Weaver plays Nina Tassler, who was a big CBS executive, wonderful woman. But like, it is just the most brilliant across the board, from the AD, we lose the kid in an hour, like everything, casting process, the entire, and nobody knows about that movie. Nobody's heard of it.
Do you remember this?
Every creator of a TV pilot. Yeah. Like last year I did one, and I said, have you ever seen it? They're like, no. And I give it to him, and it consistently depresses the shit out of the showrunner. Like, oh my God. It's just David Duchovny plays, I think it's like Judd Apatow kind of figure who's just destroyed and sees his personal story about his brother committing suicide becoming this tragic comedy, and sees it just get watered down. And Sigourney Weaver saying, so the brother's suicide, does he have to kill himself? Because suicide has been proven to be a bummer for like 64% of the people.
Suicide kings.
Yeah, suicide. We're back to that.
So, and by the way, where would one find that?
You can find that
on Amazon.
Funnily enough, does not seem to be physical media, but you can find it streaming on Amazon Prime.
There you are.
Okay, but that's new.
All
because
roads
even
lead
like
to Amazon Prime.
It was like that was one of those things that people would be like, I can't find that movie.
My God, it's 2006.
But it was even like I would order it and buy it and give it to the people.
Yeah.
And then drive around.
If you go on Amazon, you might be able to.
You might still be able to. Yeah. Was it a theatrical feature? I feel like it was a cable movie.
I thought it was a cable
something.
Movie.
Wasn't it?
No, it was a theatrical.
It's very funny. Very funny.
Yeah, very funny. So like that's just one that popped
up. Well, that's fantastic. No, that's good. That's, if you said Seventh Seal, we would have thrown
year
you out the
in
window.
The Maldives.
Yes.
For those people in the Maldives that are coming and wanting to work in the world of television. You know, it's a very ripe, I don't know, like, you know.
Talking
like,
to you, Slovak.
Yes, Slovak. Somebody
television
needs to make that new, like, woke culture satire, you know, really just like get inside of it and freaking rip it apart and, you know, really just kind of take the dig at the...
It will emerge. It will not be one of us.
No, it will not be. It will not be.
Unless we're on the way out the door.
Yeah. No.
Thank you, Mark.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on. That was a blast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Oh, my God. Yes, on the way out the door.